Welcome back to Vermont Edition. I'm Connor Cyrus.
For many of us, our introduction to puppets started and probably ended with Sesame Street. But Vermont has a rich tradition of puppetry made for both children and adults. And Bread and Puppet probably comes to mind. Vermont Public's Chantalee has been considering the puppeteers behind the puppets and the unique impact this art form can have on both creators and audiences. Shanta joins us now to talk about the latest installment of her series, Seeing, the Unseen and In-Between Within Vermont's Landscape. Shanta, welcome.
Thank you. Thank you for having me on.
So excited to talk about puppets. So let's just jump right into it. Why puppets? And it appears you've been getting a deep history into the puppetry in Vermont. Let's talk about that.
Yeah, and it's hard not to bust out laughing because I'm a child who grew up with Sesame Street, and Vermont feels like the only place where you can literally run away and join the circus or, you know, realize a deep history of puppetry, which I never considered before living here. I'm originally from Connecticut. So in my series, In Seeing, which explores the intersection of Vermont's land, art, inspiration, and identity, it felt natural to engage in exploring puppetry, given that we don't always think about it for a range of audiences. So back in May, I drove to Glover, and I basically went to the Bread and Puppet headquarters. I went to interview Peter Schumann, co-founder and co-creator of Bread and Puppet. And as most know, when you think of puppetry in Vermont, people's minds wander into Bread and Puppet. And Peter started the company in 1963 with his now deceased wife, Elka Schumann. So this was my first time visiting Bread and Puppet, and that is where a lot of conversations about puppetry in Vermont starts. Again, because most are familiar with their work. The day I arrived, I remember the road having few cars, and there was a quiet in the air on a perfect, literally blue sky day. Beyond the old white farmhouse on the side of the road, it turns out that there is a magic that unzipped because I originally parked across the street. I didn't really know where to park. And so as I drove further up the hill, I noticed all these small structures of all kinds, and it seemed to be a whole community of puppeteers. So when I started this conversation with Peter, he talked about Bread and Puppet's early days in the streets of New York in the 1950s.
We did village parades, sidewalk parades to start with, where the cops couldn't chase you because when you were moving, they couldn't do anything. Yeah, that was sort of my start of doing theater in New York. And then I realized now the real thing isn't just continue these makings of things. The real thing is to go in the street.
So these street parades tied to what Peter described as issues like the rents, rats, and police, general strikes for peace, or Vietnam. However, before all this, Bread and Puppet's roots start in Munich, Germany.
So we participated in a dance. It was called a dance concert, sort of dance competition, I think, something like this, in the America House in Munich. But the condition for participating in this contest was that either choreography or music had to be American. And so we said, well, my wife played the flute. So we said, okay, she plays the flute. That's American music. Good. Then came the first kids. We had two kids. And then we lived in the countryside, and people came outside of Munich to the little village, and we did our practicing there. Off and on went into the town. Without her, none of this would have happened.
Now, Shanta, it sounds like Peter's wife, Elka, played a pretty big role in all of this. Let's talk about that.
Yeah, that's right. Here in this next clip, Peter talks a little bit more about Elka's role.
But when Elka was in the theater, she simply did everything besides having the kids to take care of, whether it was in the garden or picking up people from a train station or whatever it was. She took the whole thing as a whole enterprise, a life enterprise.
what Peter is talking about here is not so much about gender roles. It would be very easy for our listeners to hear that and say she had the kids and she did all those things. But what he's really talking about is a totality, a non-specialized approach that he says is missing now in the arts. It was clear that he had a depth of respect for his life mate. So I had to ask, what did he learn all these years of working with his wife, Elka?
Unlimited generosity, more than anything else. Total generosity, in every aspect, whether it concerned feeding people or laboring for people or helping people out with idea development or whatever it was. And now I have to learn how to live without that. That's the hardest part.
It warms my heart to hear how he speaks about his late wife and how he talks about her generosity. Did that come out to you?
Yeah, it totally came out to me. And, you know, I've always been curious about couples who work together and create together without strangling each other. And I say
exactly.
That playfully. But there is definitely just such a depth of respect and love and also pride. I actually had to not re-interview him, but go and get another piece of the interview because he really wanted to make sure that Elka's legacy wasn't erased.
I love that. And Shanta, when we talk about Bread and Puppet, I imagine these larger-than-life puppets. And for people who haven't seen them, they're these massive puppets that often look like caricatures of people or creatures. And they have these exaggerated features, and their heads are often held up on poles by the people that are carrying them. Is that how you would describe them? Did I describe that accurately?
You did. And I actually have to say, when I went into their museum, I imagined, okay, if this was on the set of a horror film and if this was at night, these would be all so scary because they're so huge. But I want to clarify that the giant puppets that are a signature of Bread and Puppets work is something that they employed during a time when most other U.S. puppet theaters focused on, you know, what we're most familiar with, like hand puppets, marionettes, Muppet-style characters on television. But there is a distinction that was provided by a scholar, a noted puppetry scholar named Dr. John Bell, who says that the giant puppets have been something that has been used by indigenous cultures in America and other cultures around the world. And so Dr. John Bell, who's been working with Bread and Puppet since the 70s, wanted to share that this tradition, it fits within an even larger tradition. So Bread and Puppet is tapping into something that is deeper. And I was treated to a story like knowing about the large sizes and what we're used to. I had to ask Peter about their largest puppet and how it came to be. And he started to tell me a story about them making repairs on the museum, which is a nondescript old weathered two-story dairy barn. So as they were dragging things out, all sorts of dirt and other debris, Peter says he caught a glimpse of a giant piece that to him looked like a face.
And I saw that what they piled there was a face. So I just made it into papier-mâché, and then we lifted it up and we called it the
Peter
bomb.
Said he applied a bunch of papier-mâché to the form.
And it was a 30 forward to chin 32-foot face.
And this face is the piece that became one of their biggest puppets.
And we made a big frame for it, and we mounted it in the pine forest.
They, quote unquote, stored the face in the woods. I mean, can you believe it? They built this thing out of debris and then they just hung it outside in the woods. Not for a day, but several months until a storm came and went. And in terms of how the face held up.
And then the whole skin fell off, melted off in the rain of this frame. And it was beautiful. There was a skin under there, like a scalp. Under the frame, you know. That was the end of the biggest puppet.
But Peter, this was all about the ephemeral.
It's sad, but that's okay. It's called ephemeralism, right? Or what do you call it? Yeah. Things go away. They come and they go away. And we used to have the habit at the end of summers when we built so many things to make a bonfire of them, to pile them all together so we wouldn't have to store them. And that was a celebratory event.
And I couldn't believe it. They destroyed what they made.
And we weren't sad. We were happy. People brought some marshmallows and stuff, but on the whole, it was just a happy event around the fire.
So they did this every year.
At least for 15, 20 years in a row.
And these were huge end-of-summer happenings. All this talk of destroying their puppets inspired me to return to the concept of creative legacy, because as many of our listeners may know, it's something we've talked about on Seeing. And because we often think of art from the perspective of what will last beyond time, not something that we create and then destroy, it does raise the question of how does Bread and Puppet pass their legacy down?
Well, I guess it had to do with what we felt could be stored. But the interesting thing is that we don't have a decider in the company. We are absentee deciders. So we sit together, and while we have enough beer, we decide what we do. It takes a bunch of beer, six packs, and then you decide which one is allowed to burn and which one has to continue their life.
So, Shanta, beyond the size of the puppets and how Peter Schumann thinks about the legacy, what did you learn about the message that Bread and Puppet is trying to convey in their work?
What I learned from Peter that it wasn't so much about the puppets, besides their towering size, but more.
When we do these big landscape pieces here, we call them pageant. In the big field of 30 acres, out of the pine forest and so on, long distances, quarter mile long parades as part of the show. And when you realize for the audience, that isn't the spectacle. The spectacle is the weather, the sun, the cloud formations, the landscape, the whole thing, the sounds of the landscape, the little crickets, the helicopter going by.
And so for Peter, the puppets are part of the landscape.
All those big puppets that look half like trees, half like animals, they belong there.
There's also another layer that extends beyond all of this, beauty.
Beauty is what is transmitted. It's something that can't be talked about. It's confined to what they call aestheticism, but it isn't. For the Greeks, it wasn't. It was divine, and that's what it is, and you don't know why it is and what it is.
For those listeners who might be like me again, still stuck in Sesame Street land, it does raise the question, can that type of puppetry have this divinity or beauty that Peter is talking about? And he says, not so much.
It's foam rubber puppetry, basically, and it's cutesy pie, and it's ugly, and it's cartoonish, and it has no similarity to that human fantastic event of divine beauty. It's just a special branch of the commercial culture, but it doesn't qualify for divinity, for beauty.
What Peter really was also getting to within what he was talking about is the way that, seeing some of these things can also shape maybe how we access some of those different kinds of art, or just art in general. But also he went on to talk about screens shaping our reality in a pervasive way. And so Bread and Puppet challenges that.
Reality is the opposite of that secondary reality of screens and clicks and clacks and that give you whatever you want. You think it does, but it doesn't. And that's the real message of puppet. It's the reality of it. To be in a room with people, or in a field with people, on the lawn with people, and what happens there.
So Bread and Puppet went from a village in Germany to the streets of New York and then Vermont, and will soon celebrate their 60th anniversary. What's next?
Well, they're coming back full circle to their roots. They're going back to little villages, and specifically in Vermont.
We are creating little companies. We call them parking lot dance companies.
So these companies that Peter is describing are intended to be autonomous. They will be using some of the paintings that Peter has created, but they are intended to perform and rehearse without much oversight from Peter or others at Bread and Puppet. So we're talking about towns like Chelsea, Montpelier, and Glover, and they want to do others as well. So look out in a small town or village near you in Vermont.
Certainly going to have to look for those winding roads and make sure you park on the right side of the road. So, Shanta, another Vermont puppet company you spoke with is called Sandglass Theater. Tell me about them.
So the next puppet theater that I talked to is Sandglass Theater. They are a peer of Bread and Puppet and based in Putney. And like Bread and Puppet, they are local, national, and international, but with a different approach in terms of size. So for this interview, I talked with co-founder Inez Zeller-Bass, director and co-founder Eric Bass, and their daughter, co-artistic director Shoshana Bass, to explore intersections between the puppeteer, the puppets they create, and the veil that is pierced with the audience through puppetry.
For me, it was kind of sort of a process, starting as a performer for adults in this student-run theater, because that was not for children, then creating my own hand puppet show, and just discovering the love for it. And then it, over the years, it has become also, for me, some sort of a philosophy. The puppet is, for me, something that can very well live in the world of metaphor. And I think the metaphor gives the audience the possibility to really be invited with their own understanding and thoughts of what they have seen. A metaphor is something that goes deep. A metaphor is not superficial.
That was Inez speaking. And what I love about what she does is she takes us behind the scenes and creates a bridge between the puppeteer and puppet. And at the time, in the 1970s, she was in Munich, Germany. And like Bread and Puppet, they began in Germany and New York. Eric Bass started in the 1970s with a street performance through the theater The Open Eye. And for their daughter, Shoshana Bass, it wasn't just the puppets, but the puppetry that was a key part of her life. It was her whole world.
And then I came along in 87 and grew up amidst the whirl and bustle of puppet theater touring, but also hosting puppeteers in our home frequently.
As an adult, this lifestyle rooted somehow for Shoshana in the midst of all her other passions.
Then I veered off and had my own discoveries and did a lot of dance and circus and theater and directing and choreographing, and then found my way back in a kind of alchemist story where everything that I was doing in these other fields, really what I was looking for at the core was the puppetry as was taught and practiced by my parents.
And the passions run deep for all of them. Here's Eric.
And I think I never had a list. You know, it wasn't like going into a supermarket and deciding what profession you were going to take off the shelf. It was, short story is, it's the only thing I know how to do.
That was Eric Bass. And what struck me in talking to Sandglass and Bread and Puppet is the way that it was not just a way of life, but also a family affair. This is Shoshana talking about her connection to the family business.
For me, I think I'm still in a process of discovery and education and investigation. But I think there are very particular aspects of the form that are so profound to me in terms of what one practices as a puppeteer. It's very much a practice in generosity, in listening. Well, Ina spoke a lot about metaphor, but also this invitation that you spoke about, for me, I find so exciting because the puppet has this ability, because it's not, an egoed actor, and I don't mean that in a pompous way, but just in the way that we don't project as easily onto a live actor as we would onto just an object that anyone in the room can fully, freely pour anything into, and it won't take any offense because it's just a puppet. So there's a kind of like open invitation that is always there with the puppet, and there's a playfulness that I think is at the root of any kind of transformative moment. And it works for adults, it works for children, it works in so many different contexts.
And Eric adds a dimension to what Shoshana is explaining.
Yeah, I would add to that that one of the really essential ideas that Shoshi alluded to is the idea of play.
So that was Eric Bass responding to his daughter Shoshana Bass about the invitation and also the element of play. What I loved is hearing them talk about this element and how Eric expresses how much we learn from children in taking this kind of play into the artistry of puppetry, especially by the way that children enter a world and the way that they follow very specific rules during their play.
Children are really good dramaturgs.
So, Shanta, are sandglass puppets similar to Breton puppets' approach to puppetry?
Well, that is a good question. So whereas Breton puppet featured puppets that went from life size to beyond life size, with the street as the stage mostly, or a landscape, sandglass shared the range of choices.
The variety of forms is pretty large. I mean,
hand puppets.
Then there are the marionettes, which are called also string puppets, rod puppets, tabletop puppets.
And so their puppets take on a smaller feature fit for a theatrical stage, while also being clear that their puppetry is rooted within old traditions from around the world. Kind of similar to what Breton Puppet is doing with their large size puppets, being rooted to indigenous and other kinds of cultures. In addition to the stage is this piece of connecting with audience, the intimacy of that moment, similar to what Peter Schumann described about the connection with others during moments of witnessing one of their shows. So Sandglass talked about another kind of co-creation. Their work requires the audience to bring puppets to life. Much like Eric spoke about children entering the world of play, Sandglass invites their audiences to do this. Here's Shoshana again.
And there's something fascinating that happens when a puppet comes to life, because involved in that process is not just the puppet itself and the puppeteer, but equally the audience has to be part of willing that life and willing to invest in it, often with their own breath. And an imagination that is engaged. So when we do something like cast all the refugees and asylum seekers in this performance as puppets, something really interesting happens when the audience needs to invest with their breath and with their imaginations in their world and in their life.
In that clip that you just heard, Shoshana Bass is referencing their show that they created years ago, Babylon, Journeys of Refugees, which engages in storytelling created in response to the impact that the worldwide refugee crisis is having on communities. And something that hits home right here in Vermont as we have welcomed so many displaced individuals. There's also another piece of this, so I asked Shoshana.
But also intense, right? Like, because wouldn't you say that investing breath and life and imagination, especially if we're looking at an issue like displacement, especially if someone can't truly imagine that, that's a very interesting invitation, right?
It is, especially, and also as a puppeteer who is myself not someone with a refugee experience. And we speak about this a lot in post-show discussions with the audience, because there's this, I think it's rather beautiful to reach towards something you can never actually understand.
This is all so interesting, and I feel like I've learned a lot. What are some of your reflections from this, from both interviews? Because, like, I'm thinking back to the first interview where we heard generosity, and then this most recent one where we hear that same word again describing some of the people. And I think about imagination and just taking these, like, real-life issues and using our imaginations to create new stories. So what's your reflections on both of these?
It's a good question. And I'm, you know, to be honest with you, all the stories I've done still sit with me. This one's no different. I think about how creating, no matter what the medium, really is an opportunity for creating the connection with the audience, even if your audience may be anonymously viewing something. You're not necessarily on a stage, maybe with the puppets, like in this case. And also, there's a transmission of things that go beyond the surface. So, you know, Inez, you know, Eric and Shoshana of Sandglass talk about that intimacy with the audience, the transmission of things that go beyond the surface, like beauty or the idea of aestheticism and reality is something that Peter spoke about. And I was also curious about the impact on the artists and their relationship between the things that they create and then share in the world. And so I asked this question about, you know, behind the puppet, how does this impact the puppeteer? And Inez Zeller-Bass speaks to this using the example from Degeneration and Exaltation of Larks, which is an exploration of grappling with dementia within the aging process. And Inez created two different puppets, characters named Rose and Mary, for the show. And in the following clip, she speaks about how this process impacted her as a puppeteer.
I can only talk a tiny bit about this, what my experience was, and I have to go back to the Degeneration piece we did. I was responsible for two of the patients, and I had to live in both bodies. And I was not myself. I was not Inez. I was
Rose,
Mary.
We often don't think about puppets as something that would become a part of the creator in that way. We all know that writers have characters living in their heads, or in some cases, actors become their parts. But another key piece that I learned about is the impact on the audience after some of these Sandglass theater shows. Inez Zeller-Bass told me that she was trying to be true to each of those characters and create this intimacy in a lot of these shows on the stage.
I think that I felt very often the audience afterwards, they were so drawn into the characters because they were like they were living. And so after shows, people would always swamp the stage and they would go and greet the puppets and look at them and say, they're so real.
Beyond all of this, what it really came down to was the storytelling, something that bonds each and every one of us to each other.
And they would tell us stories about themselves that came out of that experience.
I think that's so at the heart of it, that story elicits story, that if you make room for story, it awakens story.
I've been speaking with Vermont Public's Shanta Lee about the past and present of puppetry here in Vermont as part of Shanta's series, Seeing. Shanta, thank you so much for being here. It has been so much fun.
Thank you. This has been a blast, Connor. I appreciate it.
And you can read Shanta Lee's latest piece and check out the rest of her series on our website, vermontpublic.org. This is Vermont Edition, and I'm Connor Cyrus.